Save big on everything for your next staining project when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture, and repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards.
At around 11 p.m. on the night of December 13th, 2020, 21-year-old Texas State student Jason Landry left San Marcos, Texas to drive back to his parents' house. But he never made it home, and what happened next remains a mystery. Just after midnight, on what was now December 14th, Jason's car was found wrecked on a desolate gravel road near Luling, Texas. His belongings and the clothes he had been wearing while driving were scattered along the road, but Jason himself was nowhere to be found. Despite extensive searches and countless hours of investigation, no trace of Jason has been found since that night. It's been more than 3 years since Jason went missing, and investigators are still searching for answers. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. So as you heard from the teaser, we're going to be talking about the case of Jason Landry tonight. And I don't have a huge opening. I try to cover a variety of cases from missing persons to murders. Some have people of interest or suspects already connected to it. Some are a complete mystery, and some, in my opinion, just need more coverage and maybe a little bit of a boost to hopefully bring this case to a close. But with this particular case, we're looking at a spectrum here, and on one end of that spectrum, it could be exactly the way it sounds. And I'll get into that as we go. I won't give it all away here. Or there could be a completely different side to the story. There could be a piece to this puzzle that's still out there somewhere, and if we were able to find it, this whole story would make sense. And even though I'd like to think that we cover an eclectic group of cases here, there is one thing that they all have in common. The victims, their families, they all deserve answers. And so that's what we're going to attempt to do here tonight by covering this case, talking about the facts. I honestly don't know how much of a perspective I'll have on it. I've had notes that I've taken on it that I'm going to sprinkle in throughout the episode, but I think this one is really more for you guys to kind of digest it, come back with your thoughts, let me know what you think, and to maybe, hopefully, have someone see this or hear this that has information that may connect some dots and bring this case to a head. Either way, we're going to cover it as best as we can. We're going to talk about it, and I'll let you guys decide what you feel once we're done. I do want to add one more thing if it's not blatantly obvious at this point. I apologize. I have a cold, so you may hear it throughout the episode, especially if you're listening just on audio. If you're on YouTube, it may not be as bad because you have a visual to go along with it, but I'm going to do my best to get through it. I got plenty of water right here, my Criminal Coffee cup. Shout out to Criminal Coffee. So without wasting any more time, let's dive into this week's case. Jason David Landry was born on July 29th, 1999, to parents Kent and Lisa. Growing up outside of Houston in Missouri City, Texas, Jason enjoyed spending time outdoors, playing baseball, swimming, and kayaking. Jason was known for being very social and outgoing, often spending time with friends and family. He also had a love for Swedish fish and quirky socks. Now, side note about these socks, because they will have a role in the story. This was a big part of Jason's personality. We were looking at the research, and what we could find is that every year his parents now host a quirky sock drive where they collect fun socks and donate them in memory of Jason. So little side note there, and it just goes to show you that's the type of person that Jason was. He was a good guy, but didn't take himself too seriously. In June of 2017, Jason graduated from Ridgepoint High School. He enrolled in Sam Houston State University. Then after a year, he went back home and attended a nearby junior college. In the fall of 2020, Jason enrolled at Texas State University, located around 2.5 hours from Missouri City in San Marcos, Texas. Jason loved music and planned to follow his passion by studying sound recording. Jason's father, Kent, later told the Austin American-Statesman that it was an unusual time for Jason to start back at college. The university, like much of the country, was under COVID-19 restrictions, so most of his classes were online, and he had to quarantine several times. Despite these challenges, Jason was enjoying his time at Texas State. He was able to visit home a few times, including during Thanksgiving break, but tragically, that was the last time his family would ever see him. On or around December 11th, Jason wrapped up his first semester. Kent later shared with Lord and Arts that Jason told his parents he would come home after finals, but he didn't mention an exact day or time. That's why it came as such a shock when at around 2 a.m. on December 14th, a state trooper called Kent to inform him that Jason's gray Nissan Altima had been found wrecked near Luling, a small town around 25 miles outside of San Marcos. Now, Luling is along the route back to Missouri City, but it's still 145 miles away, meaning Jason hadn't made it far on his journey back home before the crash. The trooper explained to Kent that an hour and a half earlier, at around 12:30 a.m., a volunteer firefighter discovered Jason's car crashed into some trees at 2365 Salt Flat Road, around 5 miles outside of Luling, but Jason was nowhere to be found. Now, it's important to note that Salt Flat Road starts as a paved street in Luling, but it turns to gravel about 3 miles outside of the town. Jason's car was found 2 miles past where the pavement ends in an extremely remote area with only a few scattered homes, no streetlights, and a lot of wild animals like coyotes and deer. According to the Caldwell County Sheriff's Office, the rear driver's side of Jason's car had hit a tree on the east side of Salt Flat Road, which then caused the front driver's side to strike a second tree and some barbed wire. When the volunteer firefighter came upon the scene, the car's headlights were still on, and when the firefighter looked inside, he saw the keys were still in the ignition. The passenger side door of the car was locked, however, it looked like Jason could have exited through the driver's side. He would have had to maneuver around the barbed wire fence, but it was possible. The firefighter contacted law enforcement, and a state trooper arrived around an hour later. He looked over the scene and concluded that Jason had likely lost control after overcorrecting on the gravel road. The trooper concluded that Jason may have been driving under the influence and potentially fled the scene to avoid a DUI charge. Now, I will weigh in here with some anecdotal experience. I can tell you that this happens more than you think. And I worked in Central Falls, Rhode Island. If you look it up, you will see it's one of the most densely populated cities in the entire country. There's not a lot of woods, but I can't tell you how many times I came upon a car accident where you have a vehicle wrapped around a pole into a fire hydrant through a fence. I even had one time where it went onto the train tracks from a hill, like down the hill through a fence, and then went airborne for about 20 feet into the train tracks. And in all of those cases, no driver. And what we would later find out is that in most of those instances, the driver fled because they were intoxicated. They figured at that point it was better to flee the area, report their vehicle stolen, and then say, hey, you know, I don't know what happened. But by that time, they're already at their home or it's the next day and they've had a chance to sober up. So for anyone questioning why the trooper would come to this conclusion, let me reassure you this happens a lot. And based on just the specifics of what we've learned so far about the condition of the car, where it was found, the time of night, that is a conclusion that is reasonable and one I think many officers would come to. Now, the trooper searched the immediate area for any signs of Jason, and around 300 yards down the road from the crash, he found several of Jason's belongings scattered along the roadway. Toiletries, a baseball cap, a tumbler holding Jason's deceased betta fish, which he had brought home for Christmas break, and also a backpack. Now, inside the backpack were many items, including Jason's wallet, a laptop, and a personal amount of marijuana. After finding these items, the trooper remained convinced that Jason was just a drunk driver who had fled the scene. He called a tow truck driver to transport Jason's car to the impound yard. He then contacted Kent, who was the registered owner of the vehicle. Kent later told Lord and Arts that after receiving the call, he immediately set out to search for Jason. His wife Lisa stayed behind at their home in case Jason returned. Kent arrived at the Salt Flat Road area around 6 a.m., and as he got about 300 yards from the crash scene, he spotted a pair of bright yellow SpongeBob socks, and he immediately recognized them as a pair of Jason's quirky socks, which I had mentioned earlier. Kent also noticed more of Jason's clothes scattered along the road, including a dark salmon-colored shirt, shorts, underwear, and slide sandals. Kent immediately pulled over and began gathering his son's belongings. When he picked up Jason's shirt, he found Jason's watch lying flat on the ground, face up. This really stood out to Kent because this wasn't just any watch. It was a family heirloom, something that held deep meaning to Jason. There was no way he would have left it behind on purpose. Kent later told Lord and Arts that he had learned these items were found just south of where the trooper had discovered Jason's backpack and other belongings. Kent noted that the clothes he had found were scattered on the road leading back toward Luling, yet for some reason, the trooper and the tow truck driver hadn't noticed them when they left the scene. Now, as far as this clothing is concerned, I can't explain why the tow truck driver or the state trooper didn't see it on their way back into town. But I will say finding the clothes heading back toward Yuling could suggest that whatever happened to Jason, he was able to exit the vehicle and decided, hey, you know what? I have just left the town. I'm much closer to Luling than I am to home. So my best bet to find someone who can help me would be to head back in the direction I just came from. So that would line up with the clothes that were found and is suggestive that Jason at least made an attempt to get back to an area where potentially he could run into someone who could help. Now, as far as Kent is concerned, after he collected all of Jason's clothes and his watch, he put them in the car and continued driving, searching for the crash site. Kent eventually found what was left of the scene, a damaged tree and some pieces of the car. He pulled over and tried searching the area for any sign of Jason, but it was still pretty dark, so he couldn't see very well. Kent then used an app to track Jason's phone, which showed that it was still with the car at the impound lot. Since he was the registered owner of the vehicle, Kent was allowed inside the lot, and after looking around the inside of the vehicle, he found Jason's phone wedged between the driver's seat and the center console, nearly all the way to the floor, and it was still powered on. We still have a lot more to cover in the story. We're going to talk about Jason's phone activity. We're going to talk about where he was before this crash occurred and photos that were taken right before he disappeared. Before we do that, let's take our first break. We'll be right back. Okay, so let's dive back into the story because after finding the items, Kent took Jason's phone along with his clothes and the watch that he had found near the scene to the state trooper's barracks. After looking over everything that Kent had found, troopers returned to the crash site for a closer inspection, but found no evidence that another car or outside force had caused the accident. All signs still pointed to Jason's car being the only vehicle that had collided with the trees and the fence. Now, I will say there are some photos, we can throw one of them up here, where you can see the gravel road and some tire tracks on that road, and some initial questions that do come into mind, and I was going to talk about it near the end of the episode, but I guess I can talk about it right now, is the idea that there could have been another car involved. And the one benefit to being on a gravel road is that you would have tire track impressions. Now, I know there's probably other cars that had traveled down that road. You obviously have the volunteer firefighter's vehicle. You have the state trooper's vehicle. You have Kent's vehicle. And you also have Jason's vehicle. So there's a few sets of tire tracks that you have to go through and cancel out. But just for the sake of this conversation, let's say those were the only tire tracks, that once you shut off the crime scene, you tape it off, you hold it till the morning, and then you go through and one by one, you cancel out the tracks that you can. Okay, here's Kent's tracks. We can cancel those off. Here's the troopers' tracks. We can cancel those off. Here's the volunteer firefighters. We can cancel those off. Here's Jason's tracks right before he went into the tree. We can cancel those off. Are there any other tracks that can't be identified? If so, we need to note that. We need to take an impression of those. They can use dental stone. It's like a cement where they can fill the tire track impressions to memorialize those tire tracks and have a representation of them if they happen to find a suspect vehicle down the road. What's also important about these tire track impressions is you can take photos and you can enhance them. But with the tire track impressions, with the dental stone that they use that at a dentist's office to make, you know, basically impressions of your teeth, they pick up the little details. So let's say a suspect vehicle had a gouge or a nail in one of the tires and we found that vehicle. There would be specific details about their tire, even though it's a regular, you know, brand tire, there would be details and imperfections about that tire that would only be specific to that tire. So you could make a match. And the fact that that wasn't done, or at least there's no record of it, no reporting of it, that's unfortunate because it does appear the trooper assumed this was a hit and run by a DUI driver who just took off. And there wasn't much investigation done into other possibilities at the time when it would have needed to be done. I say that because by going back to the crime scene, even 6 hours, 10 hours later, how many vehicles have driven down that road at that point? Probably a few. And just one or two more is going to completely complicate this situation and contaminate the crime scene, where now if you do find tire impressions that aren't matched to anyone that we're aware of, you can always use it as a defense. And basically the suspect would come out and say, well, that gravel road was unattended and unsecured for 6 to 10 hours. How do you know that a vehicle didn't drive down that road during that time frame that was similar to my client's? So it creates a chain of custody issue. And unfortunately, there's nothing you can do about that now. But I would say in a perfect world, looking at those tire track impressions from the photo that you guys have just seen, if you're watching on YouTube, it would have been nice if they secured the scene, waited till morning, and did exactly what I just said, canceled all the tire impressions and the ones that weren't identified back to someone, take note of them, make impressions of them, take photos, and maybe you need them down the road, maybe you don't, but I'd rather have them than not. Now, in addition to going back to the crime scene, troopers also looked over Jason's car and clothing for possible clues. The only blood evidence they found was a single smear on his clothes, but they didn't believe it was linked to serious injury. They speculated that the blood might have come from a minor injury, possibly caused by the barbed wire fence when Jason was exiting the vehicle. Now, even though initially they believed Jason had fled the scene, usually what happens, which I mentioned earlier, is the owner of the vehicle or the driver will call police or call a friend and say, hey, my car was just stolen. What happened to it? Usually they turn up. But that didn't happen in this case. So a large-scale search for Jason was launched, with multiple law enforcement agencies and search groups joining forces. According to News Nation, teams scoured the nearby woods and farmlands, utilizing various tools such as drones and search dogs. Now, the dogs were able to detect Jason's scent, and one trail led to a cattle guard, while the other directed the dogs to a nearby pond. Now, that pond was drained, but no signs of Jason were ever found. On December 18th, 4 days after Jason's car was found crashed, the Caldwell County Sheriff's Office took over as the lead agency in the investigation. After reviewing Jason's phone and laptop records and interviewing his friends from college, detectives were able to put together a detailed timeline of Jason's movements leading up to the crash. According to NBC, on the evening of December 13th, Jason had originally planned to drive to Missouri City at around 8:30 p.m., but he ended up staying longer to hang out with friends. At approximately 10 p.m., Jason took a series of Snapchats of himself. In the photos, he was wearing the same shirt and hat that Kent later found at the crash site. Now, at approximately 10:55 p.m., Jason clicked on the Waze GPS app, entered his parents' address in Missouri City as his destination, and started driving home, heading south on Highway 80. By 11:24 p.m., Jason had entered Luling and was heading south along Highway 80. as he passed through the intersection of Hackberry Street, which is where Highway 80 becomes Austin Street. He stopped using the Waze app and switched over to Snapchat after receiving a message from his ex-girlfriend. He continued on Austin Street until he intersected US Highway 183, also known as Magnolia Avenue. Now here's where the story takes an interesting turn, because after going through that intersection, Jason's digital trail suddenly stops. He didn't use the phone. Although it's important to note, the phone still had a signal and remained on even after the wreck occurred. So to this day, it's unclear why he stopped using it. There has been some speculation about it. We're going to get into that a little bit, but the jury's still out on that one. Now, because Jason exited out of the Waze app, detectives aren't positive where he went next. All they know for certain is that 67 minutes later, Jason's car was found wrecked 5 miles outside of Luling on Salt Flat Road. Now, I have some questions about this as well, and this is where I'm handcuffed by not having access to the police report. I understand that he wasn't using the Waze app anymore, but remember, guys, this case is only 3 years old. You have cell phone GPS. You have, at minimum, the signal bouncing off different telephone poles in that area for the signal. And more importantly, I'm assuming, again, this is an assumption on my part, he was using an Android phone or an iPhone, which would have had GPS data. So even though he wasn't in the Waze app, I would imagine that you would still be able to track his coordinates, especially if there was like a Find My iPhone app on there, which we do believe there was, because as I mentioned earlier, Kent was able to track Jason's phone via the app. So I'm definitely missing a piece of the puzzle here, why the digital trail, air quotes I'm putting that in, just stopped. Yeah, he might have stopped his activity on the phone. He may not have used his phone, but the phone was still reporting a signal and it was still transmitting activity, especially GPS coordinates. So I'm a little confused about that one, but without having access to the police report, I can't give you much more information on it. Now, as far as the crash site, detectives haven't been able to figure out why Jason ended up there. They have reviewed hundreds of hours of surveillance footage from in and around Luling, but that didn't provide any additional leads. In addition to going over surveillance footage, detectives also looked through Jason's phone and laptop and found no signs that he had plans to meet anyone in Luling that night. Because of this, they think it's likely that he took a wrong turn, and that's how he ended up on Salt Flat Road. Now let's go back to Jason's phone real quick and talk about where it was eventually found by Kent, and that was between the driver's seat and the center console, and the fact that based on what law enforcement has told us, his cell phone activity just stopped. Because people have some theories on this. Some people believe that Jason may have taken the wrong turn because he dropped his phone in the crack between the driver's seat and the center console, which could explain why he couldn't pull up the Waze app and he eventually took the wrong turn. Now, I don't know about this. I guess every person is different, and Jason had traveled this route before. I'm not saying he would have known it like the back of his hand, but more than likely he would have seen a familiar road. Yes, it's possible. It's at night, not a lot of street lights. He could have taken a wrong turn. But I pose this question to you guys. If you're reliant on your cell phone and your navigation app, and for some reason you drop it between your seat, are you going to continue driving, or are you going to pull over, grab your phone from off the floor between the seat, and continue using it? Me personally, I'm going to pull over and grab my phone because I need to know where I'm going. Maybe Jason decided not to do that. I don't know. I pose that question to you guys way down in the comments if you're watching on YouTube. What would you do? I know the area isn't well lit. Maybe you don't want to stop because it could be dangerous. But if you pull over for a second, you don't even have to get out of your car. You can keep your doors locked. Just reach down between your seat, grab your phone, and you're off and going again. I think that's what most people would do. But again, let me know what you think. Now, after putting together this timeline, detectives were still concerned that Jason could have been under the influence at the time of the crash. They considered the possibility that the small amount of marijuana found in his backpack might have been laced with hallucinogens, which could explain why he removed his clothes as he fled the scene. So because of this theory, the marijuana was sent off for testing, but the results came back normal and it was found to have been unaltered. Now, while all this was going on, Jason's father, Kent, later told CBS that he never believed Jason had fled to avoid a DUI. After driving down a dark, isolated Salt Flat road himself, Kent suspected Jason might have been startled by an animal or couldn't see the road clearly, leading to the crash. Kent further considered the possibility that Jason could have sustained a concussion when he crashed. His car was older and didn't have side airbags, which could have been an issue since the crash impacted the side of the vehicle. It seemed plausible that Jason might have hit his head against the side of the car, leaving him with a concussion, which could have caused a host of symptoms, including confusion. Adding to Kent's concerns was the fact that the night of December 13th had been unseasonably cold for Texas, with temperatures dropping to 36 degrees Fahrenheit. This raised the risk for hypothermia and paradoxical undressing, a phenomenon where victims, despite cold, remove their clothing due to a sudden sensation of warmth. And this hypothesis is not too far off. We have seen this situation before, especially with hikers who are attempting to climb mountains like Mount Everest. Later, when they find the hikers, they'll be completely undressed, even though there's snow on the ground, and this paradoxical undressing is usually the explanation for that. So I haven't seen it personally in my career, and I live in a relatively cold climate where it gets below in the teens and sometimes even below zero. But just because I haven't seen it doesn't mean that it's not possible. So you consider the concussion and then the temperature. Is it possible that he undressed himself? Sure. I don't know if I'm there yet, but I can't rule it out. In late January 2021, around a month and a half after Jason disappeared, the Caldwell County Sheriff's Office issued a statement providing an update in the investigation. They stated that they believed Jason's disappearance was an isolated incident. There was no evidence to suggest involvement of an unknown person, and they assured the public that there was no threat to the community. The sheriff's office said that they were focusing their investigation on the 67-minute window between the time when Jason stopped using his phone and when his car was found wrecked. They encouraged local property owners to check any game cameras or private surveillance systems for possible clues. They also released a flyer featuring one of the photos Jason had taken before starting his drive back to Missouri City, urging anyone to keep an eye out for any sign of him. After this statement was released, searches for Jason continued, but there was still no sign of him anywhere. By the end of the year, Abel Pena, a former FBI agent, began working with the Landry family. In an interview with News Nation, Pena explained that he had reviewed the original investigator's search data and the tips that had come in with it. He also conducted his own interviews. After his investigation, Pena reached the conclusion that Jason was not alone on the night he disappeared. He believes that one or two other people may have been involved in the crash. Pena had pointed out that Jason had driven to Missouri City before, so he would have known where he was going. Pena speculated that, quote, something happened at that intersection that caused him to go down that road that night. Or perhaps he was not driving that car that night and someone else may have been driving that car. So here's what I'll say about Investigator Pena. I am a private investigator myself. I'm no longer in law enforcement. I don't know what Abel Pena's record looks like. I don't know what cases he's been involved in, what his history looks like as far as what he specialized in. But I will tell you, he's doing this work pro bono, and this is not a highly publicized case, or I wouldn't be covering it. So you do have situations where people will get involved because it may come with some notoriety. Just on the surface of what I know without knowing Pena personally, I don't believe that's the case. And I'm not going to discredit his theory on this case because there's no doubt he knows more than I do. He's been on the ground. He's probably been to the crash site. He's interviewed people directly involved with this case. So who am I to discredit the conclusions that he's come to? I will say this. It mentions that he was able to see the search data that the investigator had, but are they opening the entire investigation to him? I don't know. I would hope that they would, especially if he's willing to do like an NDA, but I don't know how much access he has. But again, without being there on the ground in Texas, he has way more accessibility to this case, and I have to respect his opinion based on his findings because there's no exculpatory evidence to rule it out. I will say that I do wonder if I had the chance to talk to him, is this something that he's come to based on the fact that Jason hasn't been found, or something more impactful that based on his interviews he's conducted, suggests there were other people in the vehicle with him. If that's the case, then my next question would be, why hasn't law enforcement explored this path? And if they have, why haven't they said so publicly? Like, hey, listen, there's some other people we're looking at. There's some persons of interest. We're still looking into this one. Stand by. That's not what they did. In fact, they did the exact opposite by coming out and saying, hey, this is an isolated incident. There's no threat to the community. I would argue that if there's people connected to this case that are involved with Jason's disappearance and they're still out there, well, then there's still a potential threat to the community. So why would you go out there, put your neck on the line and say that unless you had something definitive? I don't know. There appears to be something going on behind closed doors that we're not aware of. I tend to believe law enforcement and also believe Pena at the same time. I just feel like there's probably not a direct sharing of information going on back and forth, and that's why there's a discrepancy. But I would love to be a fly on the wall listening to these closed-door conversations to find out exactly where we are in this case. But that's not where this story ends. We still have more to talk about, so stick around for our last break, and we'll be right back. In February of 2022, the Texas Attorney General's Cold Case and Missing Persons Unit took over the investigation into Jason's disappearance at the request of the Caldwell County authorities. For the next year and a half, the office spent hundreds of hours on the case conducting forensic tests, obtaining search warrants, and interviewing dozens of people. Despite all of this work, there was still no evidence to explain what happened to Jason Landry. In the fall of 2023, the Attorney General's office wanted to make sure that nothing had been overlooked, so they held a roundtable review with specialists from several agencies, including the FBI, Texas Rangers, and the Texas Search and Rescue. After going over the case, the panel determined that all credible leads had been followed. So let's unpack that a little bit more, because what does that actually mean? Well, if we're to go off what law enforcement has been saying publicly to this point, this is an isolated incident. They believe that Jason may have been drinking, got in the accident, and fled the scene. And just unfortunately, he never made it back to town or to anyone that could actually help. What I'm reading here is that outside agencies were brought in. They were allowed to look at all the evidence, and there was nothing to suggest that this wasn't the case. They essentially confirmed what law enforcement has been saying since day one. Now, how you feel about that, it's up to you. But I will say, having multiple agencies with multiple independent thinkers all coming to the same conclusion does hold a lot of weight. It's one of the things that I complain about all the time here on Detective Perspective, when agencies hoard the investigation and don't allow anyone else to take a look at it. They did the exact opposite here, which is also why I think Caldwell County kicked the case over to the Attorney General's office. They had done everything they could. They were probably getting a lot of backlash over it. So they said, hey, there's nothing else we can do. You take it on, rip it apart, do what you want to do. So that's exactly what they did. They said, okay, we're going to bring in agencies to come in and look at your work and see if you were right. And it sounds like they were. So what does that mean for Abel Pena and his investigation? I don't really know. But having these other agencies come in and basically put their stamp of approval on it is pretty significant. Now, fast forward to December of 2023, 3 years had passed since Jason disappeared. The Texas Attorney General's office provided an update to the public, stating the investigation remains active, and they urged anyone with credible information to come forward. Now, that could be just as simple as, we can't close the case because Jason has never been found. But as far as our investigation is concerned, we're not working it anymore. Yes, it's active, it's open, but we don't have people out there pounding the pavement daily on this one. That's my read between the lines on that one. I don't think they have people who are still pursuing leads. I think it's more of a reactive situation where, hey, listen, we've done everything we can. If something new comes forward, we'll obviously vet it, but we need people with that information to contact us if we're to do that. But until then, we're satisfied with our findings unless someone proves otherwise. Unfortunately, that is the most recent major update we have in this case. Jason Landry is still missing, and his family remains desperate for answers. Okay, let's dive into this perspective and elaborate on some of the things I've already said tonight. At the beginning of this episode, I mentioned a spectrum as far as this case was concerned. And at one end of that spectrum, it's exactly the way it looks. Jason was driving. Whether he was drunk or not, I don't know. It doesn't really matter to me. It could explain a motive why he fled the scene, but as far as the accident itself, doesn't really matter. I do think that there may be information that hasn't been relayed publicly that has been confirmed through law enforcement based on interviews they conducted that maybe Jason was drinking with those friends and that's why he stayed a little later. That's information, again, that we don't have, and it's really none of our business, to be honest. But for the sake of this conversation, let's just say he was driving and he got into an accident. He was injured during that accident. He was able to get out of the vehicle and he grabbed as many of his belongings as he could. He wasn't able to get his phone because during the wreck, the phone dropped in between the seats. That's when the phone went down there. So he gets out of the car. He grabs what he can, including things that matter to him, like the watch. And as he's walking down the road, he may have had this incident where it was this paradoxical undressing where because of the concussion and because of how cold it was, he started to disrobe. Or I have another scenario for you. Because it was cold, what if he changed his outfit before making the long drive home? I used to drive back and forth from college. It was only about an hour and a half drive, but depending on where I was going, I would always put on more comfortable clothing for the long ride. And because it was cold in this situation, is it possible that he put on a sweatshirt and some pants? Because if you remember, there were shorts and a t-shirt found. Yes, there's heat in the car. He probably wouldn't need to do that. But I don't think anyone could dispute the fact that it's possible that maybe, hey, he changed his outfit before making the drive home. So when he exited the vehicle after the wreck, he grabbed the clothes that he had been wearing before making the drive. So that could be another explanation. But you carry on. He's now slightly injured. He's confused. He's disoriented. And I think he's probably more injured than we even know, which would explain why he's dropping things. And because he's disoriented, because it's dark, he doesn't have a flashlight. He doesn't have his phone. He loses his way. He ends up in the woods or near a body of water, and he's injured or killed at that point. And that's why we have never found him. It could also involve animals as well. If he expired in the woods and he was in an open area, animals could have gotten to him before law enforcement canvassed that area as well. So that's the simple explanation. Car wreck, injured, disoriented in the woods in a rural area, and unfortunately, law enforcement just never found him. They just never found his body. Now you have the other end of the spectrum where Abel Pena has said there may have been other people in the vehicle. As I mentioned, I don't know where he would have gotten that information. What interview did he conduct where it's to be believed that someone he was with hopped in the vehicle with him and were going to make the drive to Missouri City to his home? Why would they be coming with him? Wouldn't make a lot of sense, but I'm not going to dispute Pena. Maybe he knows something I don't. What I think is more likely, if the first scenario I gave you is not right, is what I said, is that while he's driving home, there's another vehicle that pulls up behind him or on the side of him. Maybe some words are exchanged. Maybe there's a little bit of a road rage incident. And for that reason, that's why Jason goes down this wrong road, because he's trying to get away from this vehicle. And during that time, whatever transpires, he's pushed off the road. Could the individuals in the other car have stopped, seen that he was injured and decided to take him? I guess it would be a first for me. Out of all the investigations that I've worked or even covered, I've never seen a scenario where someone was involved in a road rage incident and to try to avoid apprehension, they take the person from the other vehicle. That seems like a stretch. What would more than likely happen in that scenario is if there was a road rage incident, Jason goes off the road, the other car maybe stops for a second and then takes off. Then Jason proceeds to get out of the car injured, and everything else that I said from the first scenario transpires just like it would in that case. Those are the things that I've come to. It's a 67-minute window, as they said. I don't think the digital trail going cold is a smoking gun. I really would like more detail on what that actually means, what that actually entails. The phone was still on. It was still pinging. It was still in the car. And yes, it was between the seats, which to me would explain maybe him just putting the phone down because he felt like he knew where he was going. And the fact that the phone was eventually found on the floor between the console, that could just be the result of the accident itself. Think about everything else that transpired in that moment. He could have had the phone resting somewhere. He may have been looking at it. And then when he slides off the road, hits the tree, the phone drops between the seat and the console. Perfect explanation, in my opinion. And I have to say, first off, kudos to everyone involved for allowing this type of access to outside agencies to take a second look. Secondly, the fact that they all kind of came to the same conclusion, it really holds a lot of weight for me. These outside independent investigators coming in and coming to the same conclusion when they have no skin in the game. They're coming in with a fresh set of eyes, looking for a mistake. I will tell you that if I was the detective that came in, I would try to prove my worth by finding something that could be looked into. But that doesn't seem like that's what happened here. So I leave the case with this. If forced to choose, I lean towards an accident and some unfortunate choices after the accident that led to maybe further injury of Jason, which ultimately resulted in his death. But the reality of the situation is we don't know that for certain. Jason has never been found. And could we find information, or could someone come forward who puts a whole different light on this case? Wouldn't be the first time. But the only way that's going to happen is if someone who's already on the radar or someone who hasn't been looked into yet comes forward and throws a curveball. And that's why we're covering the case, because until Jason is brought home, there's still hope. So maybe someone out there listening or watching right now will come forward with information that may change those circumstances. So just to recap, in the late hours of December 13th, 2020, into the early hours of December 14th, 21-year-old Jason Landry was involved in a car accident near 2365 Salt Flat Road outside of Luling, Texas, and he hasn't been seen since. Now, at the time of his disappearance, Jason had medium-length brown hair, a goatee, and weighed around 170 pounds. He was white, 6'1", with brown eyes. If you have information, you can contact the Texas Attorney General's office at 512-936-0742. There is a $20,000 reward for information. And if you want to help search for Jason, a volunteer group holds monthly searches. You can email findjasonlandry@gmail.com for more information. And if you'd like to stay up to date with Jason's case, please join his family's Facebook group, Missing Person Jason Landry. And my final words, as always, go out to Jason's friends and family, specifically Jason's parents, Kent and Lisa. I say it all the time. As a parent, I can't imagine what it's like to be in your shoes, but I do know that if I had a child and was going through something like this, I would not rest until I found out what happened to them. And I know just from covering this story that you're doing the same. And I hope that you get the answers very soon to what happened to your son. But until that day comes, myself and everybody who listens and watches the show will be right alongside you, hoping you get the answers you deserve. But that's going to do it for me tonight, guys. Everyone stay safe out there, and I'll see you next week.